From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's grappling with new rules from the governor for social gatherings and businesses, and the legislature is still not on board.
It's one thing to say that you're in communication with the medical community, but you know, when you're talking to people, you also have to act on what you're hearing, and that's not happening.
Also, the restrictions will mean more hard times, even for some of the state's most successful restaurants.
This year is a little more challenging in some new ways, but we're just going to continue to try to collaborate and be kind and stay grounded in the community and committed to our guiding principles and try to get through all this.
Plus, the conservatives left adrift after Donald Trump upended the political terrain.
You know, the escalator ride has become, you know, it's that famous moment where we all laughed. We all thought, no way, no way, and here we are.
Those stories coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Later on the program, we'll talk with two lifelong conservatives who are having trouble recognizing the Republican Party under Donald Trump.
What the president represents in conservative thought could fill a thimble.
That's later on in the show, but first, yesterday evening, Governor Gretchen Whitmer announced a new round of stateside restrictions as COVID infections surge. They include no more in-person learning for college and high school students, closures for movie theaters, and the indoor dining rooms of restaurants. We'll have some more on how that's affecting the restaurant industry a little bit later in the program. Governor Whitmer says the restrictions will be in place for 3 weeks as state health officials try to get a handle on spread. And meanwhile, there's an ongoing discussion about how the state's political leadership has reacted to the crisis. Rob Casalew is president and CEO of Trinity Health's Michigan region, and we're turning to him for an update on what's happening on the front lines of COVID. Rob, welcome to Stateside.
Oh, thank you, April. Nice to be with you.
Were you surprised at the governor's latest round of restrictions and guidance?
No, I was not surprised. In fact, I will say I was gratified, as well as my peers around the state.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense of what's demanding most of your attention right now in keeping the hospital's operations going?
Well, we're facing the same thing we faced in April in Southeast Michigan. We're just having a surge of patients arrive at our emergency rooms and now in the hospitals, and we are in West Michigan in a crisis at all the hospitals and climbing steadily in East Michigan. And we have about 500 of our own staff across the state of Michigan that are out with the virus themselves. So that just makes staffing even more critical.
Right. In the early stages of the virus, the pressure was just everywhere. There was a lot of pressure in ICUs, which were learning many things about the treatment of COVID. There was pressure in emergency rooms, which were trying to deal with cases and also trying to prevent contagion as much as possible. And there was a great deal of pressure on hospital operations beyond COVID, since things like elective surgeries also went on standby. Can you give us a sense of, you know, how the balance of hospital operations is going right now and which areas are under the most duress?
Well, like in April, when Michigan hit its peak, then we had eliminated all of our elective, and you know, we focused all of our energy because we were short on, you know, PPE and other kinds of knowledge, you know, to combat the virus. We brought all that elective work back, and we've been trying to maintain access for non-COVID care while we've seen the surge. But I'll be honest, it's now changing. Like in Muskegon, we've had to cancel all of our elective inpatient surgeries. We are now thinking about scaling back outpatient surgeries so that we can take that staff and dedicate them to patients with the virus. Add to that, as I mentioned earlier, the loss of staff who cannot work because they're infected. I think right now the critical focus is on staffing.
Yeah, that is an issue for hospitals of many sizes. It's less of a thing at places like Henry Ford, where you have a larger pool of workers. But we've heard a lot from smaller hospitals in northern Michigan that are in crisis stage with this. How are you handling staffing, given that there aren't a lot of other regions who have folks to spare?
Well, we have 8 hospitals, Trinity does, in Michigan. So we have done our best to shift people around amongst our hospitals to lend help. But when all your hospitals now are facing the same problem, you lose that flexibility. Trinity also, we're in 22 states as a national system. And in April, because the rest of the nation wasn't all feeling surges, we actually had nurses come here from Georgia, from Idaho, from Iowa, that helped us out in Michigan. Well, now that all those states are surging, we don't have the flexibility of nurses coming to join us from other states. So right now it's kind of all, you're on your own. And the smaller hospitals are really in a crisis, as you mentioned, and we're doing our best to take transfers from them as best we can.
Yeah. How are you thinking about capacity right now in the across the hospitals in the Trinity system? And I guess the other hospitals you partner with.
Yeah, so we all had put in place what we call surge plans, and we worked with the state back in the spring to put together ideas on how we would open up more beds as numbers climbed. And the state of Michigan Department of Health and Human Services was very good working with us in developing and approving our plans. So now we are enacting those. Like in Muskegon, we're opening up. We had moved out of the Hackley Hospital in Muskegon. Now we're bringing 20 beds back online. But here's the thing. We all have our surge plans. The problem is if you don't have people to staff those extra beds that you're opening, doesn't really do you a lot of good. So it's still coming back to staffing. So what we're doing is we're obviously pressing on the staff that we have to work overtime. We have our own pool of nurses that float around different hospitals. We're 100% tapped out on them. And now we're signing contracts with national firms who do contract nurses at extremely high rates. And we're starting to see a few of those nurses arrive in Michigan.
Do you think there's more that Governor Whitmer's administration could or should do at the moment?
You know, I think that the way we view the restrictions, I think there was quite a balance there. And we support 100% what she and the department did yesterday, because it's measured. It isn't a total lockdown. It isn't. It was really looking at where are the pressure points for this virus to spread, particularly in gatherings and public places where the virus can take hold. And so when you look at what stayed open and what closed for 3 weeks, we think it was really about the right decision in terms of trying to bend this curve.
Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey, who has been in dispute with the governor almost since the coronavirus arrived in Michigan, tweeted out yesterday his statement suggesting that the legislature has been trying to work with the governor's office, but that the governor has still been working on her own strategy without input from Senate Republicans. And you tweeted right back at him, suggesting that the legislature has really not been, as he puts it, working with the medical community, that, you know, a phone call or two is not really enough here. Could you say some more about your concerns about how the legislature has responded to the COVID crisis?
Yes, that tweet that I made last night in reply was just a culmination of frustration that I have watched along with my peers and our healthcare workers across the state of watching politics enter into the single largest public health crisis in our lifetime. And it just reached a boiling point for me last night, because it's one thing to say that you're in communication with or working with the medical community. But, you know, when you're talking to people, you also have to listen. And you have to act on what you're hearing. And that's not happening, because I will tell you, the medical community is 100% supportive of the governor and department's orders yesterday. And we have been all along. And I don't get into the politics of this. I'm not supporting the governor because she's a Democrat or against the Republicans. I'm on the side of public health. And right now she's showing us that she's on the side of public health. And I don't understand why our leadership in the House and Senate can't come to grips with the reality of what we're dealing with. And so what you saw last night for me was frustration. Yeah. And I needed to make that known and speak on behalf of our healthcare workers who are running their second marathon in 5 months on this virus.
You know, Trinity certainly has operations in parts of the state where the mask mandate is seen a little differently than in Southeast Michigan. How have Trinity staff been dealing with resistance or just even the perception that the recommendations on COVID might be might have political motivation behind them?
The one blessing we have is that our healthcare workers are viewed in a very positive light in all parts of the state. I think people express appreciation regardless of their political views or affiliations. So I haven't heard, even though it might happen, I haven't heard directly that our staff are being at all pressured to feel differently about the benefit of masks and social distancing. I do know from our staff that they're so frustrated by the avoidable infections that they see and the avoidable deaths that they see as a result of individuals making decisions not to protect themselves.
Yeah. Is there anything that you would say is keeping everybody going at this point?
Well, you know, people pick this profession and they choose their path based on their values. And we have within Michigan, Trinity, but all the health systems, we just have some of the most dedicated professionals that we could be blessed with. And what's keeping them going is what they signed up for when they chose to become a doctor or a nurse or any kind of staff professional who's dealing in the hospitals with this virus. So that's what's keeping them going. And we're doing our best as a leadership group to support them in every way we can. And by the way, there's a lot of our public who express and support them as well. And they feed off of that and they need that. And for all your listeners, we appreciate that.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you would want folks who rely on Trinity or just others around the state who may be in different places with the spread of the pandemic, anything else you'd like them to hear right now?
What I'd like them to hear is that this is real and this is serious. And what's being recommended is important for all of our safety. And I hope that everyone will become a loud voice of reason. We want our leaders to put aside the partisan politics and we want them to come together for the greater good. And I think if we as a public continue to say that and say it loudly, maybe people will start to listen.
Rob Casalew is president and CEO of the Michigan Region for Trinity Health. Rob, thank you so much for your time.
Very glad to be with you. Thank you.
Coming up, we'll catch up with the co-founder and owner of Zingerman's about Governor Whitmer's new restrictions on indoor restaurant seating.
We weren't surprised. I mean, she's actually waited longer than most states this time, I'm sure, out of an attempt to try to not have to do it.
That's next on Stateside. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The winter looks a bit longer and colder with COVID raging through nearly every community in Michigan and new restrictions on how we can gather. Governor Whitmer has put the brakes on several kinds of business, including in-person sit-down service for restaurants and bars. They're facing at least a three-week pause on that kind of service. All of our favorite spots have been bending themselves in 20 different directions since March, trying to figure out how to keep operating. With us to talk about his business is Ari Weinswig, co-founder and owner of Zingerman's. Ari, welcome back to Stateside.
Glad to be on, although I'd rather be on to talk about food or progressive leadership styles, but here we are.
I know. You and your partner, Paul, are notorious for thinking in flexible ways about your business. How have the past 9 months challenged you?
Well, I think it's safe to say it's challenged everybody. I mean, in this case, it is literally a global pandemic. So it's been a hard year or a hard 9 months for pretty much everybody. I think that all healthy organizations and all healthy people need, you know, are resilient and are always looking for ways to adapt. I mean, this has been the way it's been since the world's history began. So this year is a little more challenging in some new ways, but we're just going to continue to try to collaborate and be kind and stay grounded in the community and committed to our guiding principles and try to get through all this.
Can you think of an example of something that Zingerman's did do or did not do back in December, back in January, that has changed?
We didn't take people's temperatures when they came in. We were gathering in much larger numbers in much smaller spaces. Zing Train had people coming from all over the world to attend seminars in person and eat Zingerman's food. Zingerman's Food Tours was taking people around the world, and Corn Man Farms and the Gray Line were hosting big weddings on a regular basis. That's just to name a few.
What have you noticed about what works and what doesn't work in terms of the restaurant portions of the business during the pandemic?
I'm sure the same as everybody else would tell you. I mean, we're just trying hard to honor public safety and do our part to contribute positively to public health while still taking care of our staff and trying to provide a great culinary experience and great service experience and talk over loud cars without mufflers. The reality is, I mean, the finances in a restaurant right now do not work for anybody, really. And as a result, the one thing that I wasn't doing in December, but I have been doing since April, is be part of a group called Independent Restaurant Coalition. SaveRestaurants.com is the website. And we've done a lot of good work together. And since June, have been working extremely actively to try to get a bill passed in Congress called the Restaurants Act, which would provide much needed support for independent restaurants all over the country. So not chains and not publicly traded businesses, with all due respect, but the independent cafes and small businesses here and all over the U.S. That are struggling, and many have already closed, and many are on the verge of closing, and just people trying to stay open. So we got it passed in Congress 3 weeks ago, and we're pushing hard now to get it, if we can, get it through the Senate and get it included in whatever relief package gets passed. Because ultimately, that's really the only way people are going to survive. The PPP loans in the spring were a help. And actually, the work of the Independent Restaurant Coalition is what got that bill altered to make it much more effective for restaurants, which were generally not open or only partially open when the bill was passed. But it essentially got us about a mile and a half over a 10-mile wide river. And you know what happens when you get to the end of that mile and a half of bridge if you still got 8.5 miles to go of river.
Sure. With respect to Governor Whitmer's new guidance, was Zingerman's prepared for the latest orders?
I mean, I don't know what that would mean. I mean, we weren't surprised. I mean, she's actually waited longer than most states this time, I'm sure, out of an attempt to try to not have to do it. But I mean, I'm talking to people all over the country every day, and this is not new news. It's happened in Chicago 2 or 3 weeks ago. It's happened in New York. It's happened everywhere.
Sure. There are some locations like Zingerman's Roadhouse on the west side of Ann Arbor that have outdoor seating. Do you think that there is consumer demand to keep that going through the end of the year?
We're going to keep it here because there's no reason not to keep it here. But, you know, when it starts snowing, I mean, even today, it's pretty chilly and I'm the only one out here. But I mean, if people are game for bundling up, as they used to do back in the 19th century, I'm all for it. We're all about traditional food, so maybe it's time to start wearing some blankets. And, you know, I run outside all winter, so maybe it's time to start dining outside all winter.
Yeah. As game as you've been to sort of roll with the punches, I know this has been a very difficult year and that you've had to lay off staff. Do you think that the pause on inside seating will mean more cuts?
I don't know. I mean, we're meeting today, tomorrow. I mean, everybody's trying to, you know, you can kind of know it might be coming, but it's, you don't know what's actually going to come until it does. So it's only been whatever, half a day since we got the official word. Mm-hmm. And in theory, it's only 3 weeks. So we're trying to figure that out. And then, like I said, just trying to put a lot of work where we can to help and get this bill passed, because if the Restaurants Act was passed, then that would provide a lot of answers to keep people employed and keep our vendors getting paid, keep farmers getting paid, fishermen getting paid, and landlords getting paid, and really make the whole ecosystem that surrounds independent restaurants viable to get through. I mean, there's clearly positive news on the vaccine front. So it's a long tunnel, but maybe we can see the end of the tunnel. We just got to find a way to help the you know, again, the independent cafes, the restaurants, et cetera, and communities all over the state, all over the country to be able to survive to get to that light.
Yeah. About that 3-week timeline, does this strike you as a 3-week proposition with respect to the closure of inside service?
You know, my grandmother really wanted me to go to medical school, but I'm only a Russian history major who studied the anarchists and got a job washing dishes after I graduated. So I it's over my head. I barely understand how that, you know, antibodies and all that work. So I'm going to follow the lead of people in public health that know a lot more than I do.
Zingerman's already had some side business, including retail and online mail order food sales, which are world famous. Are people interested in that kind of food right now? Are those units having any success?
Mail order is the one thing that's extremely busy because as people don't go out and don't travel for holidays. So, yes, if people are thinking of ordering for Christmas, early is a good time to order. But we also, we do have a lot of business to be done at the bakehouse, the creamery, the coffee company for retail, and then also for carryout foods for Thanksgiving, which are booking up quickly too.
I feel like every quarantine New Yorker I know is already angling for those Zingerman gifts for the holiday season.
Be good to have them order early. Yeah. But yeah, we do have Thanksgiving stuff from the deli, the Roadhouse, the Bakehouse. Miss Kim has a really great vegetarian package. So we're just trying to come up with creative ways, again, like we said, to keep people safe and do our part to contribute positively to community health and try to stay financially viable so that we can be here when this thing ends.
You know, I take your point that it's really hard to say when that point is going to get here. But how long do you imagine it might take our restaurant industry to recover?
I mean, I don't want to sound dumb, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's there's so much uncertain right now that even if it was certain, I wouldn't really know. But in the current situation, I mean, if the vaccines work, if this happens, if that happens, if we get more grounded leadership, public health front, I mean, there's many things that could play out positively, but I don't know. We're going to just do our best in the spirit of one foot in front of the other and stay focused on our long-term vision for 2032 and stay focused on our values and try to contribute positively and be kind and treat people with dignity, which is what we've been trying to do since we opened. And let's hope we got a lot more years of that coming up.
Ari Weinswig, co-founder and co-owner of Zingerman's, thank you for your advocacy and for all the food. We hope you can stay safe along with all the staff this winter.
Thank you.
It's hard to find anyone who's happy about the latest closures, but maybe fewer less happy than the Michigan Restaurant and Lodging Association. It's posted a statement reflecting, quoting here, a profound disappointment with the second shutdown. The association says that there's an inherent and insatiable desire for humans to congregate, often over food, and it's predicting more people turning to crowded social gatherings over the holidays as a result. Is there a good answer here? Even when restaurants were open, a lot of really tough things happened. Devery Gifford is co-founder and owner of Brooklyn Street Local. From her location in Detroit, she's been serving diner-inspired breakfast and lunch all throughout the pandemic. Devery, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Devery, your location is in Corktown, and I know that some of your neighbors have closed their businesses this year. Who are you missing in the neighborhood?
Yeah, certainly. Detroit Institute of Bagels is one of our closest neighbors, and I'd say that's one of the biggest ones we're missing. We have a small block with just three businesses on it, so it's us, PJ's Lager House, and Detroit Institute of Bagels. And I've always loved our little block. We do brunch and have all kinds of variety of offerings. So. Losing them is certainly a big loss, and we hope that someone else is going to come and take up that business and reopen.
What was your reaction to the governor's news?
I wasn't surprised, to be honest. I was actually expecting it to come even last week, with cases rising the way that they are. It was not a surprise to me. you know, our priority is wanting people to be safe and wanting to stop the rise of cases. So it's certainly challenging business-wise, but I agree with the decision.
What have the last few months been like for the business?
There's certainly been, you know, been pros and cons. We've seen such great support from our regular customers who continue to order carryout, who send us messages, and who just, you know, stop by to say hi. But it is challenging, you know, wanting to make sure that our staff have hours to work, wanting to keep people safe, and also just trying to figure out what the best way to move forward is.
When I was walking around outside of restaurants these past few months, and I'd see servers working with people. I mean, servers were definitely game. They were smiling with their eyes. They were doing their best to be sure that everybody was having the experience that they wanted behind their masks.
Yeah.
But at the same time, a few times I got the vibe that people, that servers and folks, you know, that they were a little scared too.
Yeah, you know, it's a tough line to walk. One of the things that I love so much about this industry and about my business is the people in the space and the energy of the customers and the community and that feel. So we want to have those interactions. We want to have people in the space, but it definitely feels scary. And it feels hard when people, you know, sometimes we still get a couple of people come in who don't want to wear a mask, and then, you know, having to ask them to put the mask on. And yeah, there are some moments that feel really stressful and feels like, are we able to do enough to make sure that we are all staying safe?
Likewise, is there anything that you feel like you'll have to do differently to make it through however long this closure goes on?
We are going to be offering some take-home options for Thanksgiving and Christmas. So we're going to be making things like pumpkin pies and cranberry sauce that people can order and take home with them. And we're trying to think of other things like that that go beyond just our regular carryout menu. Yeah. And just, I mean, we're taking it day by day and just adapting as we can.
You know, for those who may not be as familiar with Brooklyn Street Local and the story, you and your co-founder went through so much to open this place up. You guys were in Toronto trying to make a go of it.
Yes.
And found this haven in Detroit. I imagine it's been kind of hard to watch what you've built fall on such hard times. Why do you keep going?
Well, I mean, I think I certainly have asked myself that question from time to time as well. But I do really love it. And I am really proud of the business and community that we've built. And, you know, we've been doing it for 8.5 years now and put so much work into it. And we have so many wonderful regulars and just neighbors in the business. You know, I think that's what keeps me going. And I also feel like we're going to get through this. You know, COVID is not going to last forever. The shutdown is not going to last forever. And we just have to be patient and be kind and, keep remembering the good stuff.
Do you ever think about, I'm sure this is probably a terrifying question given that some of your customers, employees may have been listening, but have there been moments over the past 9 months when you considered packing it in?
Yeah, it certainly has crossed my mind. I'm not at that point yet. I think we are going to close for the month of January. And I know a lot of other small business restaurants are considering that or have plans to do that as well, because January is always a tough month, even in the best of times. But I am optimistic that we're going to be able to ride this out.
Governor Whitmer says that this is a 3-week pause on in-person service. Do you think that that's probably realistic, or are you preparing for something that might be longer?
I'm preparing for longer. I'm anticipating only doing carryout for the full month of December.
There has been political conversation continuing and maybe intensifying a little bit after elections about what might happen or what should happen with some kind of stimulus package, although it's anybody's guess whether Congress is going to be motivated to do anything about that before the end of the year. If that were to happen, what do you think would be the useful and prudent thing to do for the restaurant industry?
Well, certainly financial support for payroll, for utilities, for our ingredients. We're lucky enough to receive funding from the PPP and several other grants. And to be honest, that is what has allowed us to stay open this long so far. So I think that funding is going to be crucial, especially through the winter months. As I was saying before, January, February are always really tough months. And when we don't have that cushion of, you know, savings from higher sales in the summer to tap into, we need the financial resources.
Devrie Gifford is the co-founder and owner of Brooklyn Street Local in Corktown in Detroit. Devrie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me. It was my pleasure.
Donald Trump may feel inseparable from the Republican Party in this moment. Up next, we'll meet two conservatives looking for a way forward. That's in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been talking with different Republicans about what they want for the party going forward. Do they like the direction that President Trump has taken the Republican Party, tapping into a massive, overlooked group of voters? Or would they prefer to see a return to more traditional conservative values? I mean, imagine being in the Republican Party as a young person because you felt it most closely aligned with your personal values, fiscal conservatism, religious conservatism, only to watch those values be stripped away by a leader whose rallying cry tapped into a very different view of the world, exploiting the national deficit and largely undermining human dignity. You aren't a Democrat, but are you still a Republican if the party looks like this? That's a question for my next two guests. We're talking today with Matt Resch. He's the founder of Resch Strategies Public Relations, and he's a former communications director for the former Michigan Lieutenant Governor, Dick Posthumus. Hi, Matt.
Morning. How are you?
All right. And we're also speaking today with Nick DeLue. He's vice president of Resch Strategies and has worked with several different Republican administrations and campaigns. Nick, it's nice to have you here as well.
Thanks for the opportunity.
So I wanted to just start out by asking, what drew you to being active in Republican circles to begin with? I don't know, Nick, do you want to start? And then we'll hear Matt answer.
Sure. Yeah. So it was sort of a family thing at first, even at a young age. I grew up in the 80s, watching Ronald Reagan on TV every night, and it really felt like he was part of the family. Felt like he was an uncle almost. So it was just sort of naturally drawn to his personality and then to politics, watching the different newscasts, talking about politics around the table with my father, who was a brilliant man and a Barry Goldwater conservative, going way back. But as I grew up and sort of, you have to make things your own, dug in, did some reading, explored, volunteered on some campaigns, and really sort of started to develop my own political philosophy, or my understanding of it anyhow, nothing original on my part. The small government conservatism. I've always sort of described myself as a single issue voter on the life issue and trying to stand up for babies. So that's one of the things that really drew me to it. But then finding in the party other issues that just made sense, lower taxes, smaller government, more local government, controlling spending, all of that resonated, continues to resonate, continue to be important issues for me.
Matt, how about you?
Well, I probably come to it with a little less pure motivation than Nick. I just needed a job. my family was not really a political family. It still isn't. In fact, I don't think it was until I was in college that I even really figured out what parties my parents were. My mom, I learned, was a Democrat. My dad, a Republican. And I knew that I leaned kind of towards the conservative view of the world when I got out of college. But I needed to find a job. And so the first place I was able to land was in Governor Engler's communications office. And so I would say that my politics was more formed by through my work career and my work life, and the issues that we worked on and the people who I worked with. I was never really a rah-rah party guy before that. I'm certainly not now, and I never really have been throughout my career. But I've worked with a lot of people and who share values and ideas that I agree with. I've worked with a lot of campaigns and a lot of causes, and it's been clear that's just kind of where I fit. And that's how my career and kind of how my life has gone forward through this point.
You guys both came of age and were coming up in times when George W. Bush was talking to Republicans in different ways about compassionate conservatism. And there was just a whole lot of new energy in a lot of ways in conservative circles. So then Donald Trump comes onto the scene. Did you take him seriously as a candidate, Matt?
I still don't, but no, I never did at no point. And in those early weeks, from the escalator ride to what was it? Was it Cinco de Mayo, where he had that taco bowl and said, the Mexicans love me because I love this taco bowl. All of these, like week after week, there was another thing that I just said, oh, that disqualifies him. He's done. That's not going to happen. At some point, one of these people who's running is going to stop this. I, at no point did I think that he was viable until, I guess, the day after the election 4 years ago.
Yeah. How about you, Nick?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. And I'm self-aware enough to understand that I missed something 4 years ago. The escalator ride has become, it's that famous moment where we all laughed. We all thought, no way. And here we are. I didn't take him seriously. It became pretty apparent pretty quickly, though, that we should during the primary process. Mm-hmm. He became he was a force of nature. I mean, he still is. But during the primary process was an absolute force of nature and was appealing to people in different ways than folks had tended to try to appeal to voters. Certainly some of that was policy oriented. There was a populism to him that wasn't common with the traditional sort of candidates. Most of it, I think, at least at the outset, was the personality and the approach that he took, the no holds barred, dirty jokes during the debates, the tough guy persona. Folks had never seen that before. It was a show and he generated a lot of attention. And I think I got it. I think, Matt would probably tell you he got it too during the primaries, that he would be a force in that process. But then you get past that to the general and I went right back to dismissing him.
Yeah.
And thought, well, no way, this is going to be a Reagan Mondale landslide.
Oh boy.
Yeah, I was wrong.
So 2017 rolls around. Did you have some hopes that Donald Trump might prove to be more presidential as he moved through his presidency?
I mean, I'll take that first. No, I guess I have had moments. I've had moments over each of the last 4 years where I had moments of hope. And those moments tended to come when he was scripted and reading from teleprompters, when he delivers remarks that are carefully crafted for him. You can tell he hasn't written them. They don't sound anything like him. You think, well, if he could do this, maybe. But those moments are fleeting.
I agree with Nick. I had hopes at the very beginning, but the moments of hope that I would ever get would kind of come by accident, and they had nothing to do with him. I can think of a couple of times where I was driving to work and listening to an NPR interview, and I clearly remember one with Kay Bailey Hutchison, former senator from Texas. And I don't know what position she held with the administration, but she was talking about something and it was articulate. It was well thought out. It was policy I agreed with. And I thought, who is this person? And then I realized, she said who she was and she's an appointee and she's doing work on behalf of this administration. And I'm like, I bet the president has no clue what she's doing, what she's saying, what these people that have been hired around him are doing on a day-to-day basis. And that's where if there's been any hope, that's where I've gotten it, is that I know that aside from the clowns who surround him at the top, there are some people down the line who I think know what they're doing and have some compass and have have been doing good things over these 4 years, at least from a conservative government standpoint.
Do you feel at this point, as he continues to be someone who wants to have a role in the party and who is having an effect on state and regional party leaders, do you feel like the problem with Donald Trump in this moment is more practical in terms of the role that he might continue to exert on Republicans, or is it more spiritual or theoretical in terms of just what he represents in conservative thought?
What the president represents in conservative thought could fill a thimble. But I guess there are a couple issues to unpack there. The one is, you know, bringing out more voters and the problem with polling. So he polled in 2020, what was it, 2.6 million voters. 2016, it was about 2.3. At the same time in 2016, he lost about 250,000 traditionally Republican voters to conservative third parties, folks like me, honestly. I mean, if we're being transparent here on the radio, who always vote Republican, but just couldn't do it. And most of those folks came home to him. With the way turnout was up so much this year, I mean, dramatically, you know, I'm not completely convinced at this point that he turned out a huge swath of brand new voters, that, you know, that there's been some great realignment, over the last 4 years. So that's, you know, one part of the question. The other is, and sort of the realignment of the conversation and the philosophy of the party and his role in it. I think the president's role right now in the party is going to continue to be outsized until January 20th and until he retires campaign debt. And then the jury's out. I don't know that we know yet what the next chapter is for Donald Trump and the Republican Party.
If you're just joining us, our guests today are Nick DeLue and Matt Resch. They both work at Resch Strategies public relations firm. They're both longtime conservatives, and we're talking about the future of the Republican Party. Where would you like to see the party go from here? Matt, do you want to start off?
You know, it's kind of a challenging question for me to think about an answer, because I've kind of stopped caring, to be honest, about the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. I think that the party system over the last number of years, and this is certainly some of the fault lays at the feet of Donald Trump, but I think it's just our narrative and just how nasty it's all gotten. It's become a sport. It's not about policy. It's not about ideas. It's about my team winning and your team losing. And it doesn't matter what you say or what you do. The other team is bad. Therefore, I'm not going to vote for you, or my team is good, and I don't care what they do or what they say. I will support them for whatever they do. You know, as a party, I would just like it to be something, again, that I could feel proud about being a part of. Nothing about this election on really either side was about a single idea. And I don't mean a single idea and that a big idea. I just mean there were no ideas. This wasn't about a policy. This campaign wasn't about policy. It was about a single person, whether or not you were motivated to support Donald Trump or whether or not you were motivated to hate Donald Trump and to try to vote him out. And I would like it to get back to the point where we're not about personalities, that the parties obviously, and we saw this with Obama. He was a personality. He ran because he inspired. He was less about the policies and less about what he wanted to do. And he was just an inspirational figure that inspired people to support him. And you see the same kind of cult of personality with Donald Trump. And I think for the health of the party, it's not sexy. And, you know, the hardcore political consultants are going to say this isn't going to win any elections, but it would be nice to go back to a time when there are common ideas that we all agreed on as a party that we could promote and feel proud of. And I don't think anybody, I would love to ask, you know, the percentage of the people who voted for Donald Trump to ask the question what the Republican Party stands for. Because I would guess that at this point, very few of them could say.
Yeah.
They would just say, we stand for him. That's what it would be.
I think the opportunity that the Republican Party has now, though, is a clean slate if they want one. Does the party choose now, you know, as it moves forward, does it take the look in the mirror and figure out what went wrong, make those calculations, and then start fresh? Or it can look at those ideas and claim that it supports those ideas and backs those ideas, and, you know,
who knows, April, does Donald Trump Jr. or Eric, or, you know, what does it do 4 years from now?
Could we just talk a little bit about whether this is a time to where some reformation of what both parties stand for? I mean, there are any number of progressives who are really upset with the moderate views of their party. And the assumption has always been that there were, you know, that there were Bernie Sanders voters and there were Joe Biden voters and never the twain shall meet. But some of that is now under discussion on the left. Do you think that there is that opportunity to talk about a reformatting of priorities on the right?
I would hope so. But my fear is that the people who are in a position to lead that conversation, for the most part, you know, let's just, I don't want to point fingers at the Michigan legislature, but, you know, we have a Speaker Wentworth right now in large part because of the motivation that Donald Trump led, you know, people to the polls to vote for Republicans at a time when we thought every lobbyist in Lansing thought the House was going to be democratically controlled. And my fear is that people who are in those positions don't think there's anything wrong, that this is that this is not something that we need to change, or that we're doing the right things because we're winning. I don't want to say that I wish we hadn't won the House, because I think I'm grateful that we did, and I'm grateful that it looks like we'll hold the U.S. Senate. But at the same time, sometimes a disastrous loss is cleansing and makes you actually rethink things. And I think that I'm hoping that the lessons learned, we can go and look at how we do things better and how we do move on beyond this guy once he's gone.
Reformatting is an interesting way to frame the discussion. There are opportunities, I think, for the Republican Party, even not under a Donald Trump, to continue to expand its base into non-traditionally conservative places. And I think one of the blessings that's come from the Trump approach for Republicans could be the roadmap that he's sort of highlighted in a couple of key constituencies. One, we didn't see this in Detroit, but we saw nationally, the president performed in 2020 much better with minority voters than he did in 2016, and then Republicans had done for quite some time. Why was that? Well, let's figure that out. I think it's because he paid attention to some issues. I think some of it was maybe personality. I don't know we know completely, but let's figure it out. But I think he made inroads there. And does the party moving forward continue to embrace sort of a populism and making direct appeals to blue collar workers, to union members? If it does those things, maybe it continues to hold on to some of that vote.
I found myself thinking as we were getting ready for this conversation about Justin Amash, who's leaving Congress this year. And he left the Republican Party because he said he no longer recognized it or the people around him who were his peers in the House. I just wondered if you two feel like you still have some kind of place within the party, or if you could imagine your activism finding a home in different places.
I guess I would still say that if I had to pick, I'm a Republican, because I feel more at home in what I think the Republican Party is than I ever will probably with what the Democratic Party is. So that's not really probably going to be an option to me. I definitely feel as I get older, my attitude on a lot of issues moderates. So I split my ticket more this time than I probably ever have before. I would be happy if I could come back to a point where I would be proud to say that I'm a Republican. And I think that hopefully when we get to a point where there's another leader, I mean, I could basically anybody would be someone who I could say is better. I wish Justin would have run for president. That would have been my answer.
Nick, how about you?
Yeah, I stopped referring to myself as a Republican 4 years ago. I just didn't feel particularly welcome or wanted, to be honest with you. That doesn't mean that my ideas or my beliefs or my sort of foundational principles have changed at all. In fact, they haven't. Do I still think of myself as I guess I describe myself as conservative, and I wouldn't anticipate my activism finding another home. You know, at the end of the day, we're going to have, you know, two choices on the ballot, on position after position. I'm not going to be voting for a lot of Democrats. I'm probably not splitting my ballot quite as much as Matt is, but we are dealing with a two-party system for the most part, and folks are going to find their home. You know, you mentioned April earlier. You know, are the Bernie Sanders Democrats going to be able to coexist with the Joe Biden Democrats? Well, that's a better choice for them than Donald Trump, right? So they found their way to where they had to find their way. I think we're all going to be in that position.
We've been talking today with Nick DeLue and Matt Resch of Resch Strategies Public Relations Firm. They're both longtime Republicans. Guys, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
I'm April Baer. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you again on Tuesday.